From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Red China Blues, we talk with Chinese-Canadian journalist Jan Wong. She first went to China as an idealistic radical student in the 70s and supported the Cultural Revolution. She even informed on some would-be defectors. But she eventually left China disillusioned. Years later, she returned as a reporter for the Toronto Globe and Mail and covered the Tiananmen Square massacre. Also, childhood memories of dictatorship. We talked to Haiti's new Minister of Culture, filmmaker Raoul Peck. His new movie, The Man by the Shore, is about a child growing up in the early days of the Papa Doc Duvalier regime. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. It appears that Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole will resign from his Senate seat to focus full-time on his presidential campaign. The Kansas Republican has scheduled an afternoon announcement at his Senate office and plans a trip to Illinois to reinforce his decision. Dole aides say the resignation won't take effect until the end of the month and perhaps not until early June, giving Senate colleagues time to prepare for the transition. Word of Dole's decision has flowed like a tidal wave throughout political Washington. Families of the victims of ValueJet Flight 592 will visit an area near the crash scene today in the Florida Everglades for a private memorial service. This as federal investigators continue looking for the cause of the crash that killed all 110 people aboard. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports.
Fire department officials will take family members to a levee in the Florida Everglades, about 400 yards from the site where the remains of the DC-9 are buried in the mud. They won't be close enough to see the crash site or the ongoing effort to recover bodies, but the levee is as close as they can get and still be on dry land. Once there, a chaplain will hold a brief memorial service, a wreath of flowers will be placed on the water, and family members will have some tranquil time to remember their loved ones. The visit was arranged after repeated requests from families to see the wreckage, which is located in a remote part of the Everglades, miles from the nearest road. The families had asked to fly over the area, but federal officials rejected that idea as too dangerous. I'm Adam Hochberg in the Florida Everglades.
The Clinton administration has targeted Chinese clothing and electronics goods for sanctions. The goods are worth $3 billion. Washington is complaining that Chinese firms are stealing American-made movies, records, and computer programs, and that Chinese authorities have done nothing to stop it. The retaliatory tariffs would take effect June 17th unless China does more to stop the piracy. U.S. businesses say the thefts cost them $2 billion a year. President Clinton speaks today at a memorial service for slain law enforcement officers. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
Mr. Clinton will join recording star Mariah Carey this afternoon, along with thousands of police officers and survivors of fallen officers, in paying tribute to the 163 police officers who died in the line of duty in 1995, as well as nine others killed in previous years. Mr. Clinton will deliver the keynote address at the National Peace Officers Memorial Service, an annual ceremony organized by the Fraternal Order of Police. Yesterday, Mr. Clinton proclaimed today Peace Officers Memorial Day and this week Police Week, the president praising America's law enforcement officers for putting themselves in harm's way to safeguard their fellow citizens. Mr. Clinton called their dedication to the rule of law essential to maintaining a just and orderly society. Bill Small at the White House.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen nearly 25 points to 5,649. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. The leader of the Japanese cult linked to last year's deadly Tokyo subway attack is urging his followers to turn themselves in to authorities, but he scoffed at the suggestion the group poses a threat to society. From Tokyo, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
OM leader Shoko Asahara announced, "I want everyone to follow my orders and surrender." Seven OM members are still wanted by police for their role in last year's Tokyo subway attack. Asahara spoke for an hour before a special panel, hearing arguments on whether the OM should be banned under the country's never-before-invoked anti-subversive law. I have no intention of instructing the sect to conduct any subversive activities, Asahara said at the tightly guarded Tokyo Detention Center. As for his prophecy of Armageddon, Asahara said it had already been fulfilled by the assassination of Israel's Yitzhak Rabin. OHM has already been dissolved as a religious organization and declared bankrupt, but applying the tougher anti-subversive law would amount to an outright ban of the group. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
Officials in Bangladesh say Monday's tornado killed more than 500 people. Medical teams and soldiers are caring for tens of thousands of other people who were hurt. Another 500 people are still missing. 80 villages were devastated by the tornado. Thousands of homeless people slept in the open when the tornado struck, despite the frequent rain. The storm also felled communication lines and blocked roads with debris, making rescue effort tough. Nepalese army helicopters have rescued two climbers from Mount Everest. They're identified as Charlotte Fox of Aspen, Colorado, and Michael Groom of Australia. They were taken today to Kathmandu Airport. Both left without talking about their climbs. No more evacuations are planned today, even though climbers are still struggling to get down the peak after one of its worst ever blizzards. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jan Wong, used to be a true believer. In the days when China was radical chic, as she puts it, she believed the glorious things she heard about the revolution. As a Chinese-Canadian teenager in Montreal, the daughter of a prosperous restaurant owner, she wanted to experience the harmony of the Cultural Revolution and live in the workers' paradise she believed Mao was creating. In 1972, at the age of 19, she left Montreal to study at Beijing University. She stayed for the better part of 8 years. When disillusionment finally overtook her, she returned home, went to journalism school, and became a reporter. In 1988, she returned to China, this time to cover the country for the Toronto Globe and Mail. She stayed for 6 years and won several journalism awards, including the George Polk Award. Jan Wong has written a new memoir called Red China Blues, My Long March from Mao to Now. I asked her to explain why she first went to China.
China, to me, was like a utopia. It was a mysterious country far away. It was the home of my ancestors. And I thought that they were the first country in world history to try to do the right thing, to try to make people equal, to end oppression and end exploitation. And so I thought of it as this almost like a Disneyland, something where nothing would go wrong.
You arrived in China in the middle of the Cultural Revolution. What was your introduction to the Cultural Revolution?
Well, I remember going into the hotel room, and I just felt, this is such a weird place. I mean, to have a hotel lobby covered with slogans. And I also remember seeing lots of soldiers on the street. And having come from an era of protest against war, I was quite taken aback by so much militarism. But I also felt this is a wonderful country because the women aren't wearing makeup. There's no pantyhose. I don't even see a wedding ring. And as a budding feminist, I was just beginning to become a feminist in those days. I thought this is terrific.
And what was your status as one of the first two students from the Western world allowed to study in China since the Cultural Revolution?
Well, we were in a very special position. The other girl, I call her girl because we were 19, was an American Chinese. Her name was Erica. And she and I were treated, I say in the book, we were treated like revolutionary royalty. And it was ironic because they were so good to us. They gave us our own cook just for the two of us. They opened up a deserted dormitory. You see, the schools had been closed mostly. And they had a deserted dormitory. They moved in an entire class of Chinese females to be our friends. And we had our own teachers. And we had our own typist who would do our vocabulary lists for us. And the ironic thing, of course, is that we didn't want privilege. We didn't want to be different. We wanted to be just like the Chinese. And so we fought to do physical labor. At times, we even cried so that we could join in.
And you thought that that would be good for you, that it would be humbling, it would take away your kind of inherent bourgeoisism?
Well, I had read Mao. I had read a little bit of Mao, and Mao had said, you know, your class background really determines the way you think. And I had come from a very nice middle-class background. My father owned restaurants. He had actually made his first million by the time he was 40, only he never told us. And I thought, that I really needed to reform my thinking. If I was going to be of any use to this world, if I was going to do good in this world, I had to get rid of my bourgeois thinking and think like the proletariat. And Mao had said that if you do a lot of physical labor and understand how things are created, and if you know how hard it is to do physical labor, you will change. And I used to do all this stuff and kill myself. I would work so hard that my hands would shake at the end of the day and I couldn't even hold chopsticks to eat dinner. I'd be so exhausted. But I would stop sometimes and think, well, how's my mind doing? And really, you know, all I did was dream about fresh peach pie and French fries. And so I don't think I was making any progress.
Let's talk a little bit about what your education in China was like. You had one teacher who you called Fu the Enforcer.
Yes, that's right. The education was very strange. It was the middle of the Cultural Revolution. I was trying to learn Chinese, and I had what you might think were ideal conditions. I was in a completely Chinese environment. I had my own teacher, and my teacher didn't speak English. But while that was very good, it was also very tough. It was total immersion, not just language-wise, but culturally. And I call her Fu the Enforcer because she was a hardline party member, and she would scold me for all kinds of things. And she also had this tremendous prejudice against me because she knew my father was a capitalist restaurant owner. And so, for instance, during lessons, she would say, well, we won't do this story because it's about a blood-sucking restaurant owner and we don't want to hurt your feelings. So Erica would get that chapter. Erica's father was a professor. And she would tell me things like, oh, her parents love her more because they're not as corrupt as your parents. Your parents are the bourgeoisie. Her parents are sort of bourgeois intellectuals, but they don't exploit anybody. So they love her more. And I would feel kind of hurt and devastated. And I should also say there were no dictionaries. I had to learn Chinese without a dictionary because they had all been trashed during the Cultural Revolution. And so it was really hard trying to understand things. And my teacher was so out of touch with the outside world that she didn't realize that other languages had verbs. And I remember one lesson when she was trying to explain this concept to me, and finally it dawned on me, she's telling me what a verb is. And I said, you know, we have verbs in English.
What was your social life like?
Ah, the social life during the Cultural Revolution. Well, it was almost non-existent. Erica was the only person I could speak English to in that time, except for a Swedish diplomat whose phone number had been left behind with me, for a group of Americans, American Chinese who were touring China, had felt pity for me when I suddenly was told I could stay behind and study, and I didn't know anybody. So they gave me this guy's phone number. I called him up, and I saw him occasionally, and we had this sort of very innocent relationship. We liked each other, but we had never even held hands, for instance. But the Chinese were really upset because he was a diplomat. And in those days, diplomats were considered to be spies. And I'm sure that some were. But as far as I know, he wasn't. He was just a Sinology student who got a temporary posting in Beijing. So we got into all kinds of trouble. And to make this very long story short, I was told not to see him anymore. I thought about it, and I decided I really wanted to be Chinese and to do the right thing and to be like them, and they must know what they're doing, and maybe he is a spy. I mean, who knew? So I broke off with him, and then I bumped into him, I guess several months later, accidentally at somebody else's place, not realizing that we were under surveillance, that we were being watched all the time. And soon after that, I think a week later, they tried to expel me from the university. I was told simply that my studies were over. And the greatest, probably this for me was a real turning point in China when I stopped becoming a true believer. They told me that I had always asked to leave in February. And my roommate and all my friends, all the Chinese friends, my teacher, the administrators in charge, all insisted that I had asked to leave in February. And of course, I hadn't. I had expected to study until the summer. And that was a real eye-opener for me. But the funniest thing was, so I sold all my clothes at the secondhand shop. I sold my bike. I sold my desk lamp. And I called my parents and I said, look, I'm getting kicked out. You know, I have to come home. And they got all upset and they pulled strings in Ottawa at the Chinese embassy in Ottawa. And they managed to get me reinstated. So the funniest thing was, all of a sudden, the administrator came to me and said, okay, you can stay. And you were always supposed to stay. And then everybody else fell into line, and they all pretended it had never happened. And if it weren't for Erica, and if it weren't for the fact that I had no more clothes and my bike wasn't there anymore, I would have thought I had simply been hallucinating. And that, to me, really showed me what China was like, that people can say anything in complete seriousness, and they don't mean it. They just have to lie.
Of course, the big question is, why did you want to stay? First, this is a country that was anxious to get rid of you because you were seeing somebody who was a friend of yours. The rules were really quite rigid. Weren't you getting wise to the system by then? Why did you still want to stay?
I was getting wise to the system, but Mao always had an answer. He would say, well, we're in the stage of socialism. There's still class struggle left. That's why there's bad things. So I could understand why there were glitches and why things would go wrong. That was all explained away. Why did I want to stay? Well, I felt it was such an unusual opportunity to see and live in China. Nobody else had that opportunity. And I felt it was important to do that and to see it. And I also wanted myself to change, and I thought this was the way for me to change, is to be in this kind of socialist boot camp. And I thought it was good for me and maybe good for the world if I went and suffered a little.
My guest is journalist Jan Wong. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jan Wong. Her new memoir is called Red China Blues, My Long March from Mao to Now. You twice went so far as to report other people to the authorities. You informed on a Chinese student who wanted to go to America, and informed on parents who wanted to send their daughter to America to study. What made you think that that would be the right thing to do?
Well, it was the context of the times when I was trying very hard to do the right thing. And I, of course, as a Westerner, I felt, you know, this is snitching. Should I do this? But I was also trying to put myself in the Chinese mindset and trying to do the right thing. They would want to save this person. And I had read Mao, and he had said, well, for the enemy, of course, you're merciless. But for one of the people, you try to save them and reform them with gentle criticism. And I thought that the student would be reformed through criticism. She would be saved. I thought it was appalling that she wanted to go to the West, because I thought of China as sort of a worker's paradise. And when she started asking me, well, I didn't know her very well, and she didn't know me, because had she known me, she would never have asked me. She would have realized I was a complete fanatic. But she approached me and she said, tell me about what it's like in the West. And, you know, I had been in China almost a full year. Actually, I'd been in China a year by then. And nobody had asked me about the West. Nobody talked about the color televisions and the refrigerators, because it was an almost pornographic topic. To talk about the decadence of the West was a no-no. It was a taboo. And she wanted to talk about it, and I felt very uncomfortable. And I said, it's a capitalist country, you know. And she said, yes, I know, and I want to go. So I thought about it. Erica and I were both there, and we both discussed it, and we thought, well, we should report it, because that's what we're supposed to do. And also, we wanted to save her. And, you know, it wasn't a big moral decision at the time, because I didn't know what, I didn't think anything bad would happen to her. And because we weren't told what was happening many times, so I never knew what happened to her. And it was only when I started to write this book that I went back and looked at my diaries. And this is in the 90s, when I'm a foreign correspondent in China. I looked at my diaries. I saw what I had done. I had completely forgotten. And I was appalled. And I went back and I found my classmates. And I said, whatever, do you remember this incident? And they did. And I said, well, what happened to her? And they said, well, she was hauled before the entire class, and she was denounced. And then she was expelled from school, which was a horrible thing to have happened to you in those days, because it was such a privilege to go to university. So when I write about it in the book, of course I hesitated, because I don't want people to think I'm a terrible person, but I did do those things. I did make mistakes. And why I think it's important is because I realized that that was such a part of Chinese culture. My roommates were snitching on me. People were reporting on me. The reason I was almost expelled for seeing this Swedish person is somebody reported on me. And I wanted to show what an integral part of Chinese society that was. And later when I was a correspondent and after the Tiananmen massacre, the Chinese set up a hotline, what I call a snitch hotline. And people were supposed to report any of their friends or colleagues or relatives who had gone to demonstrate in the square. And I remember as a correspondent being just so delighted that people were not calling in. People, the only people that would call in would say, I want to report a mass murderer and his name is Deng Xiaoping. But people were no longer turning in their colleagues and their friends. And to me, this was a wonderful step forward in Chinese history.
A month after your graduation, the Cultural Revolution ended, and everybody made a big ideological switch. What happened?
Well, Mao had died, and his widow was suddenly arrested. And she was head of a faction that later was called the Gang of Four. They were very radical. And I was really shocked because everybody was ecstatic that she had been overthrown. And I just began to realize I didn't understand the first thing about China.
You must have felt like a real sucker. You know, you're a Chinese Canadian who goes to China during the Cultural Revolution. You become the most fanatic in supporting the Cultural Revolution and so on. And then suddenly the Cultural Revolution's over. Everybody changes ideologies. And what does that say about the time that you spent in China and everything that you believed and supported, all the sacrifices you made? Did you feel like a sucker?
Yes, I felt really stupid. And I knew I couldn't leave China at that point. I had to stay. I had to understand this country and how I had been so duped. But I didn't feel like I had wasted my time because I might have been two steps behind the Chinese, but there was a point earlier for them when they also believed, when they also, you know, ate it up and did everything they were told and thought maybe they could really reform their minds too. I was just several steps behind them. And when they stopped believing, I didn't realize they had stopped believing. So it was valuable for me to have gone through that process, to have snitched on someone, to understand how they could do it. For later, I could understand that they weren't evil people who had snitched. They were just ordinary people who had been caught up in this tremendous brainwashing and tremendous control of people.
When did you leave?
I left in 1980, that first time. And I came back to North America. I went to school, and I went to journalism school, and then I became a reporter.
And you went back to China in the late 80s, early 90s?
Yes, I went back in 1988 for the Globe and Mail as the Beijing correspondent.
I like the way you say in your book that you switched from being a true believer to an objective observer. It must have been very interesting to return to China after having been a true believer there.
Well, sometimes I felt a bit of nostalgia for the old days, even knowing that there were so many problems. When I first went back in 1988, I was depressed. I looked around me, and you have to remember, this is the kid who went and thought the Mao suit was beautiful. So then I go in 1988, and the women have permed their hair. They're now pulling out their eyebrows and replacing them with these shiny tattoos. I was depressed. And even the young men were getting perms. And everybody wanted to be taller. So the women were wearing high heels. Even the men were wearing high heels. These young toughs would swagger about the street corners playing pool, wearing stacked heels. And even peasant women in the fields, I would see them hauling these, you know, cartloads of grain, and they would be wearing high heels. It was very depressing because everybody seemed to want to ape foreigners. They wanted to have lighter skin. They wanted to be taller. They wanted to have these round eyes. They would get these operations where they would slit their eyelids and so stitch them up and make an extra fold. Because double fold eyelids, as they call them, are sort of Western. And I found that very depressing after all the Chinese had gone through.
You covered Tiananmen Square for your newspaper. And you write that you couldn't decide who was more foolish, the gerontocracy or the students who were drunk with their newfound celebrity. I think, you know, in America, the story has mostly been covered as the good guys, the students, versus the bad guys, the government. You saw it differently.
Yes, well, it is very tempting to write a David and Goliath Goliath story or to write good guys versus bad guys. It is tempting, and I think I'd like to blame my brothers in the electronic media for that. The television cameras, they need a simple story, and the students could play right into that with their, you know, they were photogenic, they had the red silk flags. I think it was a complicated story, and I don't think I did particularly well reporting that either. I mean, it was very tempting. Your editors just want a simple, dramatic story. But the students were very irritating. For one thing, this hunger strike was not really a hunger strike. I found people with food in their packs, and they thought nothing of, like, having yogurt, because that wasn't a solid food, so it was okay to have yogurt. I found kids who were hunger striking in shifts. They would, like, miss a meal, go back to campus, eat, come back, miss another meal. And they were sort of obnoxious because they set up a mini bureaucracy in the square with their own government and their own passes, and we were issued passes, the journalists were issued passes, and we had to go through 18 checkpoints to get to, like, an important student leader. So they were really aping their own government, and of course they had no other models, you can hardly blame them, but it wasn't that pleasant. They weren't that nice, but it was all right. They didn't deserve to die, for sure.
But you thought they made a lot of mistakes.
Yes, but they're kids, you know. And so I as a student who used to sit in my university chancellor's office, I could forgive them for making mistakes.
Now, you got married the first time that you were in China while you were still a student there.
Yes.
How did you meet your husband?
Well, we actually met at a party, not a communist party, I like to say. he is an American draft dodger, and as far as I know, the only American draft dodger who decided to go to China instead of Canada. You know, most of them went to Canada. And he had been working there for a Chinese propaganda magazine as a translator, because foreigners were not allowed to do anything except language-related work. And I remember seeing him the first time. He was wearing a Mao suit, a thick padded Mao suit. It was wintertime, and a Mao cap over his head and Chinese glasses. And I thought he was Chinese. He's not, of course. He's actually a Jewish New Yorker. But I remember talking to him for the first 10 minutes in Chinese. He's fluent. He has no accent. He speaks wonderful Chinese. And only later, when somebody else came over and joined us and he spoke, you know, New York English, did I realize that he wasn't a foreigner. Sounds kind of stupid, doesn't it?
No, but it's interesting that, I mean, the marriage lasted.
Yes, and we're sometimes astonished ourselves. But we were both raving Maoists, and then luckily we were both there when Mao died, and we saw what happened. So we went through that change together, and then we both came back and went to school, and we sort of become sort of middle-aged sort of materialists together. Of course, he doesn't really like buying sofas and home decorating, but what I mean is we've traveled the same political journey together, and so we're still together, and it's going to be almost 20 years this fall.
Well, Jan Wong, I want to thank you very much for telling us a little bit about your adventures in China. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jan Wong's new memoir is called Red China Blues, My Long March from Mao to Now. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Coming up, we meet Haitian filmmaker Raoul Peck. He's also Haiti's new Minister of Culture. His new movie, The Man by the Shore, is about a child living in fear during the early days of the Duvalier regime. It's based in part on his own memories. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Raoul Peck, is Haiti's new Minister of Culture. He's also one of the country's few filmmakers. His new movie, The Man by the Shore, is set in 1960, during the early days of the Duvalier regime. The repression is seen from the eyes of a child whose parents flee to Cuba but are forced to leave the children behind with their grandmother. Peck was a boy when Papa Doc Duvalier came to power. Peck's father, an agronomy professor, lost his job. In 1961, he left for the Congo, which later became Zaire. The rest of the family followed a year later. Raoul Peck has also lived in Paris, Berlin, and New York City, where he first drove a cab and later taught at New York University. I talked to him about his childhood memories of dictatorship. He told me that, unlike the child in his film, he didn't actually witness beatings, but he was fearful because of the conversations he overheard.
You should be aware that when you are a child, adults used to talk while you are around, and usually they think you're not listening or you're not understanding. And when I left Haiti, the Duvalier regime was already well known for its abuses. And my father was arrested twice. And one of the aspects of the film that people always ask me about, why are those streets so empty? And it was like my own memory. I remember my mother taking me in the car and driving through Port-au-Prince trying to find out where my father was. And I remember it was a curfew, and so there were no cars, nobody in the streets. And those are images that stayed with me.
Were you very frightened driving in these deserted streets with your mother looking for your father?
It's strange, but I don't remember the fear, in fact. The fear came later, but there it was just like almost an adventure. You know, you don't really understand everything. You know it's a special situation. You know something big is happening, but you don't really realize how dangerous it is. So that's why you keep it in your memory, not especially as something bad, but you know it was an event for you in your life.
What was your father arrested for?
Well, in fact, for nothing political, in fact. You know, the specificity of the dictatorship was that when somebody else came to power, everybody that was linked or is not a vivid supporter of it, is in danger. And in the case of my father, first of all, he had lost his job. He was a professor at the agronomy school in Port-au-Prince, in Damien. And he lost his job right after Duvalier came to power. So he went back to the countryside and tried to, you know, to do his business. And he used to come like every 5 months to the capital, try to sell his coffee and for exportation. And so he used to go in different houses of export. And somebody followed him, and they arrested him, saying that he was trying to group the businessmen against the new government. But I suppose it was a vengeance of one particular person that didn't like him or for one other reason was not his friend.
So when your father was released from his temporary imprisonment, did he tell you much about what happened inside? Was he beaten when he was there?
No. It wasn't. And maybe that's our luck at the time. The Duvalier regime was not yet did not unleash its power at this time. They were still looking for their right place. And there were still a number of military that was there. And I think one of them recognized my father. And that's what probably protect him somehow. So he was released, but other people were not that lucky. This is, I would not stay too much on that because what happened to my father was nothing to what happened to other families. I think in my own family, in friends' family, I know where I grew up when I was a child. I know a family that completely disappeared. Their father's mother were arrested, and we never knew what happened to them later on.
Remember, you were saying that when you're young, sometimes the adults around you don't count on the fact that you're actually comprehending what they're saying. So you hear things that you're not intended to hear. What were some of the things that you heard, that you overheard the adults talking about when you were young in Haiti?
Well, there is one scene in the film that I've used. I wrote it and I directed, I edited, and only after a few months after the film was completed, I found out that this scene was something that I saw, really. And it was the scene where Sarah's father is teaching her how to use a gun. And I remember my own father teaching my mother in the garden how to use a gun. She wanted to have some sort of protection at the time because there were people, Duvalier's thugs, coming in every official building and asking the public servant, you know, on what side they were, you know, and the people who were not supportive of the regime would be thrown out of their office. And I remember my mother saying, well, they're not going to get me. And I remember this particular afternoon, my father and my mother leaning on a garden wall and, you know, trying to use a small little gun. I'm sure it would have done much to those guys. But this image stay with me. And it came out in the film without me knowing it.
When you realized that the scene of the girl being trained by her father how to use a gun was a memory that came from your own life, that your mother was trained by your father to use a gun, mm-hmm. What reaction did you have to realizing this actually happened in my family? You'd forgotten that it happened.
Yeah.
What was your reaction when you realized this is actually a memory?
Well, it's I'm somehow used to that mechanism because I found that in a lot of the films I did that a lot of things came from me somewhere deeper, and I think it's the way people deal with their past, whether it's something beautiful or something dramatic, and as a writer, I deal with that all the time. So it was not much of a surprise. It was most, oh, I got caught again. It was more this kind of reaction. And I'm amazed even today when I'm watching the film, you know, I'm discovering small things, you know, and why I use this music at this particular moment. There are things that I did consciously. There is one song that we hear in the night while Sarah is talking about her mother that had left Haiti and went to Cuba. And she was saying, well, she doesn't love her mother anymore. And we hear in the background a song playing by a radio. And this song is, I use it because it's the song that each night when something dramatic did happen during the day or was going to happen. That's what the song that all radios played in Haiti. And it was, you know, it's and it became like an alarm. And this song, I'm sure that when most Haitians hear it, they know also the meaning of that. And I just put it as a background in the film.
What kind of events did the playing of that song warn of?
It could be like somebody have been arrested. It could be that a whole family have been killed. It could be that a so-called complot have been discovered in the military. It could be a group of Haitian exile group trying to land or trying to topple the government. You know, that was the kind of event it would mean.
When that song was played on the radio and that was an alarm that something big was going to happen, what would people do to prepare for what this mysterious and alarming event was going to be?
Well, usually you stay home, you close your doors and your windows and you wait. That was the only thing you could do, you know, and sometimes not open any light in the house. And you would, you know, I remember a lot of whispering, so people would not talk loud, you know. And since that time, I think I was amazed when I start to go back to Haiti in the 80s. It was strange how people had lost the ability to talk openly about anything, or sometimes when Haitian would come visit us outside, when they could leave the country for a while to come visit parents or relatives, they would also keep whispering. You know, as soon as they would talk politics, they would start whispering, although they were in the United States or in Europe. And it's a strange habit that you know that you take without noticing it and that you keep.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Raoul Peck. He's the Minister of Culture of Haiti and the writer and director of the new film, The Man by the Shore. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Raoul Peck, Haiti's Minister of Culture, and the writer and director of the new film, The Man by the Shore. After moving with your family to Africa, you moved later to France, to Germany, to the United States. When did you decide to go back to Haiti?
Well, I remember once after the death of Papa Doc, I don't remember exactly how old I was, maybe between 14 or 16. And I remember going back for vacation with my brother. And it wasn't the terror time anymore of Papa Doc, but and it was a time where Baby Doc was so-called Baby Doc. I hate to use that because it makes it so
cute,
so nice, cute.
Yeah.
But at the time he was like opening, I think, trying to say that, well, Haiti have changed and you can come and invest in Haiti. And so my parents sent us to see the family back there. And I was happy to be there. I felt welcomed by my family, my friends and all that. But at the same time, I felt like it was a prison and I could not do what I want. I could not talk how I wanted to. And then I decide never to go back unless I have something particular to do, unless I'm coming to do for a particular task. So when I came back much later, after Jean-Claude Duvalier was ejected from power, and since then, not only I decided to come back, but I decided that Nobody could be able to tell me when to come back or not, because it's a situation you put yourself in when because you can wait forever. You know, when if you are waiting that the situation is going to be, best and without danger, without with the best condition, you would never go back. Even today, Haiti is not a paradise, but and it's not going to be a paradise. We shouldn't be naive, but. So if you want to do something, if you want to be home and take part in the change of your country, you have to be there, no matter what the situation is. There is a whole generation that have lived through the dictatorship because they were not in a position to leave. They could not leave. So if they could do it, I mean, any one of us can do it and should do it.
How long have you been Minister of Culture?
Well, it's it's very new. It's I've been appointed 2 months ago with the new government.
And what does it mean? What does the position mean?
Well, first of all, it's a huge responsibility in a country where everything have been destroyed. The government have found, even physically, the ministry are totally destroyed. The military have broke everything. They took even the telephones, wired, everything. And you have, a population that have gone through so many ordeals and so many difficult times that they are kind of tired of all that. The Ministry of Culture is responsible for a certain amount of institutions like the National Archive, the National Theatre, National School of Art, the National Library, the institution for the protection of the patrimony, like all the monuments and buildings in Haiti. So it's a very large field that we have to deal with basically no money. With not a lot of human resources.
I know you recently bought a theater that you're going to use, I believe, for independent movies, art films, and for theater. Tell us more about your intentions and, why you bought it.
Well, it was the result of an experience that I had last year. For the first time, we have decided to show 5 of my films in Haiti. Some of them have been shown sometimes under very hard conditions. But for the first time, we wanted to show them as a package and as a really cultural event. So we did a festival called Autopsy of Terror, which was also a way of summarizing all those 30 years that we have known until we could have democratic elections. What I must say, all theaters are in the hand of one company in Haiti. It's practically a monopoly, and so that's everybody have to go to this one person to get access to a theater. So that's what we did, and it was a long negotiation. And finally, when we agreed and we made our program, and when the program was published, the theater owner asked us if we were willing to take out one of the film because he thought the film was too dangerous to show, and asked us to redraw it. So I say, well, if you want to do that, you should go to the press yourself and say why you want to redraw it and do it. So of course he backed off, but he did a he recorded a text saying that he was happy that I've chosen his theater to show my work, but that the theater was not responsible for the contents of my films. So, which is something that is unheard of in the whole history of cinema, and so it's the experience was really a very wonderful one. Almost 10,000 people came to see those films in 9 days.
Wow, that's extraordinary!
Yes, it was really, and it was a catharsis for a lot of people. I had people telling me that. It was difficult for me to sit through the whole film because suddenly a lot of memories were coming up and that things that I thought I had forgotten. And for a lot of Haitians, that was the first time they would be confronted with this reality. Because, you know, to survive all those years, somehow you have to forget a lot of the things.
Right.
And keep on living. And now, for the first time in their life, they were confronted to it in a very dramatic way.
My guest is Haitian film director Raoul Peck. His new movie is called The Man by the Shore. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Raoul Peck, and he's Minister of Culture in Haiti and the writer and director of the new film, The Man by the Shore. You didn't make your new movie in Haiti. You made it in the Dominican Republic. Why couldn't you make it in Haiti?
Well, first of all, our idea was to make a film for the first time in Haiti, and a political film, and a film where everybody would be involved in. It was like a gift after the return or after the election of President Aristide, which for us was the sign that never again we would have that type of dictatorship like the one we had before. And we started working on that. We started pre-production in Haiti. And like 1 month before we could start really working on it on the field, there was again a military putsch. And of course, you can imagine what it meant for us, and not only in terms of the production itself, but, you know, in terms of what we were trying to do in the first place, you know, like saying, well, that will never happen again. And I had to change part of my story, the ending of my story, following that. And it took us almost a year to be able to set up the production again. And finally, we decided to go to the Dominican Republic to shoot the movie, which also at the time was a hard political choice, because the relationship between the two countries, or let's say between the Democrats of Haiti and the Dominican Republic, were not very good, because from our point of view, the military of the Dominican Republic have somehow helped the military in Haiti. So it was a very difficult situation for us. But what we did is try to work as much as possible with the Haitian inside the Dominican Republic, you know, to make them part of the whole project.
Does democracy in Haiti still feel very fragile to you?
Well, I don't see democracy as something you get once for all. It's never secure anywhere. Even in Europe, even in the United States, there are, if you take it on a relative basis, of course there are a lot of things that are established, but still on the day-to-day basis there are still a lot of injustice here and there. In Haiti, I think we come a long way. 10 years are nothing, but in those 10 years we have for the first time established the first transition of power in peace and tolerance. We had two democratically elected presidents that could exchange their power without, you know, bloodshedding. And this is something important for us. We had election for new senator, for new congressmen, for new mayors. And all those are points that are going to be there, whether we like it or not. And now it's how we are dealing with it in a day-by-day basis. Because you can't erase 30 years of dictatorship like in 1 year. It's going to take time to find out what can be our new relationship between one another.
Your next film is going to be an adaptation of Russell Banks's novel Continental Drift, and I believe Willem Dafoe is going to star in it.
Yes.
Tell me why you are adapting this novel.
First of all, when I read this novel, it was one of the first time, I guess, I had the feeling of an American author really having another vision of its own country. Having a vision that was really humanistic and not based on race or not based on just the American dream, you know, the illusion of the American dream. Russell Banks questioned the American dream. And in this particular novel, he questioned two sort of American dream. The one from the blue-collar, white American citizen, and the American dream of the immigrant, in this case a Haitian woman, and the mixture of those two dreams that somehow collapses together was really for me the perfect setting for what my films are about. You know, it's about people, it's about class, it's about not ideology, but it's about, you know, way of seeing life. It's about choices you make. And I found A Continental Drift a perfect illustration of that. In particular today, in America today, where you can see this xenophobia coming up again. Although this country is built on immigrants, now you have people who are extremely active against immigrants, you know, and forgetting where they come from.
Well, Raoul Peck, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for receiving me.
Raoul Peck is Haiti's new Minister of Culture. His new film, The Man by the Shore, opens in New York Friday. We've got a real treat coming up for you Monday on Fresh Air, a concert and interview with Peter Minton, who has a vast repertoire of well-loved and forgotten songs of the 20s and 30s. He's just finished a long stay at Bemelman's Bar at the Hotel Carlyle in Manhattan, the hotel where Bobby Short has performed for decades. Monday, we'll hear Peter Minton sing and play. Here's a piano solo from his CD Deep Purple. This is I Won't Dance. Peter Minton will sing and play forgotten songs from the 20s and 30s Monday on Fresh Air. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Kathy Wolf, Barbara Bogave, and Joan Tui Westman. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
So Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dow Jones Business News and Information Services, featuring Dow Jones News Retrieval, an online service where business finds answers. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the extreme mood swings of manic depression. We talk with two people who've written about their experiences with the illness, psychologist Kay Redfield Jamison and novelist Kay Gibbons. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.